There's always been this question that journalists and economists and later historians go back and forth on. How much influence over the economy does a president really have? They can lay out priorities, say what they want Congress to spend money on, try to guide the labor market and fiscal policy, and then many years later, we can start to try to figure out how they did. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, we enter a new presidency.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
The era of Donald Trump has started, and now it's time to see whether the policies he's promised will really go into place, what residual things will stay from the Obama administration, and what all of this will mean for the economy, the country, and for Americans. As always, come share your thoughts with us at Marketplace.org, on Facebook, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. Most presidents have big plans for their first 100 days in office, and President Trump is no exception. His inaugural address was an aggressive reaffirmation of his priorities. To talk through those plans and what they mean, we are starting off our show this week with Marketplace's Washington Bureau Chief, Andrea Seabrook. Hi, Andrea.
Hey, Lizzie.
Let's talk about the first 100 days. There's always so much focus on that. I want to go even more kind of micro speed. What about the first week? President Trump has said he's going in hard. What does he want to do immediately?
Yeah, that's a good question. 7 days is a lot easier to think about than 100 days when it comes to this transition. President Trump has said before he became president that he wanted to hit the ground running. It is true that he had so-called beachhead teams in place ready to take their seats in, you know, the various office buildings around town the moment of inauguration. But there's a lot of drag on the transition, in part because it was a surprise to many people in the Republican Party that he won in the first place. And so there wasn't the kind of transition team in place before his election that there usually is. But apparently it's ramping up quite well. First order of business is to get a lot of his nominations through the Senate. There are still confirmation hearings coming up in the Senate this week for several of his nominees. And interestingly, the Democrats in the Senate have vowed to take as much time as they can on the Senate floor to debate nominations, so after they've been passed out of committee. So it'll be a while before Trump has a full cabinet in place. It could be weeks and weeks.
Well, let's map out the next couple of months then. What's on the wish list?
What's on the wish list and what's on the to-do list are two really different things, right? So President Trump will want to roll back the Affordable Care Act. He and congressional Republicans want to get rid of as many regulations on business as they can, regulations they see that hurt the corporate atmosphere in the United States. They want to lower taxes. Those are all on the wish list. Now, the problem is, It's hard to do a lot of those things, and you sort of can't tackle a lot of them without also coming up with an entire federal budget plan. So
because a lot of these things depend on, you know, the money for them.
And in fact, if you're going to cut spending, the way that they plan to get rid of or replace Obamacare, in fact, is through a process called reconciliation. That can't happen until there is a budget blueprint. So you kind of can't do one without the other. And he's going to have to come up, let me say again, the congressional Republicans, president is not a king, they're going to have to come up with a total government plan, basically, for every program. That is a huge task.
Let's talk foreign policy for a second. There are a lot of global challenges out there. What are we looking at in terms of the first few months where the Trump administration is going to try to bite some of these things off?
Well, the Trump administration has no choice in many ways but to continue involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan, for one, you know, renegotiation, working against ISIS, working for new governments in those places. Plus, let's not forget Syria, the Aleppo tragedy. This is still a huge problem in that region of the world. And there is always a question of, you know, the countries that are near and around Israel. So At the same time, it is becoming increasingly clear that there is sort of multi-country war brewing in Central Africa around the Gambia, where there's a democratic crisis going on. And, you know, terrorism itself, international terrorism, is the top priority of really any post-9/11 administration when it comes to foreign policy.
And we haven't even gotten to Russia yet.
And we haven't. Oh, right. Goodness. How could I not mention Russia? I mean, yeah, an entire it seems like there could be a renegotiation of the relationship between the United States and Russia, not to mention negotiations between the United States and Pacific Rim countries with whom we have trade pacts. I mean, there is so you can't separate foreign policy in a lot of ways from the rest of everything. He has got to bite off everything at once.
Andrea Seabrook, our Washington bureau chief, as always, thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie.
You heard Andrea say it. One big question for the Trump administration: what will replace the Affordable Care Act? This week, Congressman Tom Price, President Trump's pick to head the Department of Health and Human Services, had his first of two confirmation hearings. He declined to get into specifics about plans, but he did say this.
I think health savings accounts and high deductible catastrophic coverage are things that make a whole lot of sense for many individuals. And we ought not force anybody to do anything. It ought to be a voluntary choice, but they ought to have the choice to be able to select them.
Those high deductible or catastrophic plans work this way. You pay most of your own medical bills, usually thousands of dollars, before insurance kicks in. Price and congressional Republicans say these plans are a big part of what should replace Obamacare. And it's not just them. Democrats and employers have also embraced these plans. But here's the thing. People who study health care don't know whether high deductible plans actually lead to good care. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has the story of one doctor who's trying to find out.
Dad's home.
Hello!
Dr. Ashish Jha's three kids rush the door as we walk in. Wrestling with his four-year-old was sweet tonic after his 11-day business trip. Hong Kong, Paris, Florence, stolen briefcase, too. I'm here tonight to talk with Ashish about an unusual experiment he started about a year ago. He signed his family up into a high-deductible plan.
I thought it would be really useful as a family to know what it actually feels like to have to pay for everything out of pocket, at least until you hit your deductible.
Now, the family's on the hook for thousands of dollars in medical expenses until they hit their $6,000 cap. What kind of guy makes his family do that when he doesn't have to? The kind who's a doctor, a health policy professor at Harvard, the kind of guy who spent the last dozen years trying to make healthcare work.
And high deductible health plans are supposed to be one of those things that's supposed to make the healthcare system work better. And none of us has the exact right answer for what American healthcare needs to look like.
What experts like Ashish have known for decades is high deductibles force us to cut back. The question is, what do we cut back on? Wasteful stuff like name brand drugs or the critical things like canceling a cardiologist appointment? And whose care do we cut back on? Ours or our kids? Ashish's wife, Deb Stump, says what they've learned is that they do a lot of guessing, like when their son needed a follow-up after surgery.
In the past, I would have just called and made the appointment. This time, I was pretty sure since I was a specialist, it was going to be quite expensive.
When it came to their son, taking a cautious approach beat out money.
I sat on it for a while, and then I called Ashish, and Ashish said, yeah, you should probably have the follow-up. So we went, and it was probably a two-minute visit and ended up costing $465.
The couple gambled, and they've realized this experiment, this new health plan, was affecting most of their healthcare decisions.
This experiment, it's stressful. It's difficult.
This is the new normal for Ashish and Deb and thousands of families. Families in high deductible plans. Now they have to shop for treatments, usually with no prices, no information on quality, and no way of knowing what treatment's worth it. So the question is, if Ashish Jha, a doctor and a health policy professor at Harvard, can't figure this out, what do the rest of us do?
What I take away from Ashish's story is that simply calling the patient a consumer doesn't make buying healthcare anything like buying cars and computers.
That's Harvard economist Amitabh Chandra. Chandra's research shows people in high-deductible plans don't really shop around, even when they're given a state-of-the-art computer program to compare prices. What troubles Chandra even more is that the healthy and the sick skip out on the care that they need.
Prevention, imaging, drugs, consumers were cutting back on all of those. And that's a sign that they don't really know what care is valuable and what care isn't valuable.
Chandra's work has helped solidify consensus. High deductibles are great for healthy people. They come with cheaper premiums, and most of us are healthy. But if you're chronically ill, poor, or unlucky enough to get hit by a bus, they can be a disaster. And it almost was for Ashish. The morning after he got back from that bruising business trip, his heart started pounding.
Imagine like running as fast as you can, and when you stop and your heart is racing, that continuing for minutes and minutes and minutes, it's not a great feeling.
Ashish has a condition where his heart can rev up. These episodes happen once or twice a year. They usually pass pretty quickly. This time, at half an hour, it was still going. At an hour, his wife wanted him to go to the ER.
And I was resisting it. She actually asked me, if a patient of yours called you with this, what would you recommend to them? And I said, oh yeah, that's easy. Go to the emergency department.
Ashish dug in. He didn't want to drop $2,000 or $3,000 or $5,000, even though he knew this could be a heart attack, even though he knew he could afford it. Did you make a mistake? Should you have gotten in that ambulance that morning?
Boy, that's a hard question to answer. I mean, you know, I should have gone to the hospital. But, you know, I knew there was a big bill waiting for me if I did, and I rolled the dice.
He got lucky. After an hour, his heart started to slow down. Ashish's experiment is helping him see what's backed up by research. High-deductible health plans can put people in difficult positions. In moments, they force you to be your own physician. That's something even a physician struggled to do for himself. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We love doing the numbers here at Marketplace. It's our thing. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers, Tony Wagner and Eliza Mills, as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Hit it, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
80,000.
That's how many people subscribed to Vanity Fair after President Donald Trump tweeted insults to the magazine about a month ago.
Some companies fear what Trump's comments could do to their stock prices, but Vanity Fair managed to turn the tweet into, Twitter aid.
The whole thing started with a scathing review of one of the restaurants in Trump Tower.
Longtime editor Graydon Carter told Politico the century-old magazine has never been more profitable.
$90 million.
That's the amount Trump's inauguration committee raised for the big day as of last week.
That cash pays for the parade, the concerts, the fancy parties, and more. Taxpayers cover the actual swearing-in.
How does that compare to Barack Obama's inaugurations?
Well, in 2009, his committee raised $53 million, and in 2013, they raised $44 million.
Not that it's a competition or anything. $325 million.
That's what American households spend every year just trying to get their babies to sleep.
That's all manner of items, from swaddling blankets to special bassinets that cost more than a grand.
It's nice if you can afford it, but experts say you don't really need much to keep babies safe and comfortable.
A doctor told us you can make the perfect baby bed with a mattress, a fitted sheet, and a cardboard box.
We're going to turn to some other things happening in the news with our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance, long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it, and apply them to the news. Here to join me this week is Marketplace's Rima Kreis and LA Times reporter Natalie Kitroev. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Lizzie.
Thanks.
Natalie, let's start with you. Tell me about your long.
I'm long on companies going public in 2017. 2016 was a pretty dismal year for IPOs, initial public offerings. There were only 105 U.S. companies that went public in 2016. You know, part of the reason why 2017 is forecast to be a better year, and I believe it, is that you couldn't really get crazier than 2016. The markets were just really tumultuous, and it made it hard for CEOs to feel as though their share price would be stable or as if really the markets would support a successful IPO. And so they stayed away from it. 2017 has potentially Snapchat going public, potentially Uber, potentially Spotify. So these are big players that could really kind of jolt the IPO market. Trump is also expected to bring good news for companies that normally face really heavy regulatory burdens when they go public. He said he wants to axe a lot of regulations, and it sort of seems like a lot more companies could be willing to test the waters, if you will.
I mean, I had the chief marketing officer of Spotify on not too long ago, and he dodged that question about whether they were going public, but certainly did it with what I would describe as an audible wink and a nod. How about that?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Often these IPOs are the subject of rampant speculation, and we obviously don't want to do that here, but there's a lot of signs that the market's rally post-Trump is actually pretty stable. You know, not much has changed since the initial rally. And there aren't any events on the horizon that would suggest further sort of craziness. It's still up in the air, but there are good signs.
Rima, I feel like your long actually kind of joins this together nicely because you're also looking at companies and corporate leadership. Tell us about your long.
I'm predicting that there are going to be more women rising to the top in some of the bigger companies in the U.S. So I read this great Wall Street Journal article about it. It was very optimistic. There are lots of women sort of waiting in the wings, so to speak, in these bigger companies that are predicted to take over as CEO or president. That's the case for Kohl's, Abercrombie and Fitch, Verizon. Last year, a woman was promoted to CEO over at Tupperware. And so it's the trend that we're seeing is that more women are competing for these positions, but it's happening internally, and they're having a better shot at getting them. I chose this because, you know, I feel like we're always bombarded with these really depressing statistics. The last time I checked was like less than 5% of women hold a top position at a Fortune 500 company. So that's really sad. But the pool of qualified women, it is growing. We're seeing more women enrolling in business school. And when it comes to academics, women are generally outperforming men. I also read something from the consulting firm PwC. They also suggested that things are looking up, but that by 2040, more than a third of new CEOs will be women, which is still, you know, it's a third. It's not parity, but
it's a lot closer.
Yeah, it is.
Let's pivot to your short, Natalie, because this gets into money and sports and really the big money-making effects of sports, but also where the financing for a lot of the sports we consume comes from. Tell me about your short.
I'm short on big public subsidies going to sports franchises, especially the NFL, and I'm talking about stadiums here. This is something I just wrote about for the LA Times with the Chargers moving abruptly from San Diego to LA. What prompted that was that the team had essentially asked the taxpayers of San Diego to pony up over $1 billion in taxes. It was a hotel tax, so maybe tourists would have paid it, but to build a new stadium. And the taxpayers, voters rejected it overwhelmingly in November. So that was a big no. The broader context here is that it is, experts say, becoming a lot harder for franchises to secure large kind of chunks of funding for their buildings from the cities in which they live. And part of that is that taxpayers are realizing that these things don't actually generate that much economic growth. And, you know, that's been a big promise behind them. And then the other kind of selling point is that is the intangible part of this, which is, you know, you get a hometown team or you get to keep your hometown team. The value proposition there is kind of seems to be shifting. And these stadiums are getting so expensive. They used to cost $400 million. Now they cost more than $1 billion.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, right?
The economic argument, as you pointed out, that a lot of sort of public-private partnerships that are trying to bring stadiums to various cities have made is that economic growth is improved or that downtowns are revitalized. That's certainly the argument we saw in Washington, in San Francisco, when we were talking about baseball stadiums. And you're saying that that doesn't hold water.
No, it doesn't really.
Even adding a second team doesn't do much?
No. I mean, it does a little bit more because it adds a couple more games. But in the case of the NFL, it's very few games. Baseball stadiums tend to do this a little bit better than NFL because there's so many baseball games. But the other economic argument is that, you know, with, for example, in the AT&T Bank where the Giants play, that was built with private money. The Warriors' new stadium is going to be built with private money. The new NFL stadium where the Rams and the Chargers will eventually play is private money. And the point is, like, if this is such a good investment, wouldn't the market sort of flock to it? And and there are examples, really successful examples of privately built stadiums. You know, Staples Center was almost entirely privately funded and obviously is a success. So fans are looking to those examples and saying, wait a minute, you guys can do this. You don't need us.
Yeah. You don't need our money. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Well, speaking of other industries that take our money, Rima, let's talk about your short, because as a New Yorker, I am someone who orders a lot of things to be delivered. It's a very New York-y thing to do. Tell me about how your short fits into this.
Yes, my short has to do with delivery apps. So DoorDash and Postmates, they came out with news this week that said that they were testing out something different, and that is robots, self-driving robots, that will deliver your Chipotle burrito to your apartment. So if you want to think about it, imagine like a cooler on wheels, and they're supposed to, like, they're not supposed
oh
to go.
Oh, my God.
They're just going to be roaming around the cities. And they're not supposed to go that far. I think it's within a two-mile radius. And Postmates and DoorDash are partnering up with Starship Technologies, and they're just testing it out at this point in a couple of cities. But they're looking at them as a complement to human delivery. So they're not looking at it as something that's going to take it over necessarily.
And why are you short?
Well, that's also part of the reason why I'm going short on it. I just don't see it picking up on a massive scale. Part of the argument in having these robots is that it'll save costs, because this is a business with high turnover rate. It's a business with thin margins. It can be a logistics nightmare. But to me, as an outsider, it seems like involving robots adds more logistics, and that could be complicated. Like, how will a robot cross the street?
How will a robot get to my second floor walk-up?
Yeah, and I think the idea is that they won't necessarily, that the person will meet the robot. But I think for something like this to really pick up, as I said earlier, it has to be on a massive scale. And I don't necessarily foresee that happening. And what do you think,
Natalie? I agree. I totally agree. I mean, the whole Amazon drone promise has not come to fruition. I mean, partly because those drones, you know, the places that they've landed are like some random rural strip of land where, you know, there's much fewer regulations involved in landing in, you know, a farm in the middle of nowhere than navigating a city and, you know, interacting with everything.
Or a suburb and telephone poles and trees and, yeah, all sorts of the FAA regulations, all of
exactly.
those things.
I mean, I'm frankly, you know, when you think about those delivery guys and women and their jobs, I'm more concerned about the robot that is the self-driving car for them. I mean, you know, Uber is kind of investing in that. And that,
as our car companies, yeah.
Yeah, that seems like a robot that could actually take off and would.
Yeah.
But the cooler thing, first of all, the cooler image is just
hilarious.
Wow. Yeah. I kind of want to see it, even if you're short on it. Like, I want to see that on our streets.
Natalie Kittura from the LA Times, Rima Kreis from Marketplace. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Thank you.
President Obama is now ex-President Obama, a private citizen. That got us wondering, how do presidents make money once they leave office? They get a pension from the federal government, but that can only go so far. And how'd that start anyway? Justin Vaughn is an associate professor of political science at Boise State University. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
let's say a modern president, you know, packs up the moving trucks, they do all that stuff, they walk out of the White House, and then what? Where does the money come from?
You know, it really depends on what they had going on before they walked into the White House. The ones who came in independently wealthy or who had already made their fortune, or many of them didn't have maybe that much time left in their life after the White House. You know, those were easier decisions. But for those who were young and maybe hadn't yet made their fortune, that becomes a real pressing question.
You know, is it fair to say that the closest analog we have seen to President Obama is former President Clinton?
I think there are some similarities. I think President Obama is probably a much more comfortable situation than President Clinton was. President Obama had more personal wealth going into the White House than President Clinton, and he's leaving the White House with, I imagine, most of that money still in the bank and not with huge, you know, legal fees facing him from some of the legal situations that President Clinton had in the last few years of his administration. He's also maybe in a little bit more flexible situation because when President Clinton left office, Hillary Clinton had already entered the public service. A lot of the choices that they made had to kind of operate within the constraints that his partner was going to maintain her status as a public official, and also, you know, that ethics requirements and even just the politics and optics of regarding ethics would be something to consider as she made her eventual run for the White House.
Well, how do presidents typically make money once they are out of the White House?
There's a range of opportunities that presidents have. I think the most common ways that they make money right now are writing their memoirs and subsequent books, and then also going on that lucrative speech circuit. So you see President Clinton, for example, received a historically large advance for his memoir that ended up being, you know, an unbelievable bestseller. But that was something that other presidents had done too. You know, Ulysses Grant, Richard Nixon, you know, even Harry Truman eventually got a large advance that helped them pay the bills after they left office. But then you see presidents like President Reagan, who right after leaving office went on a speaking tour, including a notable $2 million kind of trek through Japan.
And I gather it's Truman who set the precedent for a presidential pension?
When he left office, he had no real personal wealth and was in pretty dire straits financially. And so a few years after he left office, Congress passed a law that created this $25,000 a year pension, which he really desperately needed at the time. The only other living president at that time was Hoover, who was in fine financial situation, but he also agreed to take the pension in part as a way of making it more acceptable for Truman to do that without, you know, looking like he had his hand out.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, there is sort of this fascinating moment here where the country felt it was unpatriotic, really, for a former president to be in dire financial straits. It feels like we've come so far from that moment now when a book deal can command tens of millions of dollars.
Yeah, absolutely. And so just really a half century ago, we weren't really prepared to permanently take care of our chief executives. In part, that became bigger deal because our presidents have become younger men, and in part because suddenly, you know, being a president was a much more visible position within the United States, much more important political institution. And, you know, after World War II, so with respect to Truman, we're now the global hegemon, and, you know, alongside the Soviet Union, where the rest of the world's eyes are upon us. And it doesn't necessarily look that great if your most important, most prominent official, after leaving that job, has to put his hand out or go back to, I guess in Truman's case, working in a hat shop.
You know, when we think about what President Obama may step into, he has sort of publicly toyed with a bunch of different things. Venture capital, owning part of a sports franchise, certainly writing his memoirs. Do you think that changes now that he is not sort of cementing a legacy, as I think many in the White House thought he would be with Hillary Clinton after him, but looking at someone who shares very different political beliefs in President-elect Trump?
Yeah, for sure. I think when it became, you know, increasingly likely and then now certain that he would not have that at least one more term of a like-minded partisan to further insulate the impact of his policy accomplishments, that suddenly President Obama seemed much more interested in keeping his hand in the political game.
You study this. What do you think he's going to do?
If I had to put money in it, I think that the venture capital approach would make a lot of sense. It's very lucrative. It also can be, he can be very picky in the projects that he gets behind. And then it also really takes advantage of exactly what his skills and personal resources are, in that it's putting together people from the tech industry that he, you know, is very interested in personally and cares about, with global elites who have the deep pockets to fund, you know, big initiatives. And he's the most famous guy in the world, right? He has a pretty good Rolodex. So there's very few people who are better positioned to be that kind of linkage agent in the VC world than Barack Obama.
Justin Vaughn, Associate Professor of Political Science at Boise State University. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
President Trump reaffirmed his stance on immigration in his inaugural address. He's called for a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico. Now that he's taken office, what happens to those plans and our relationship with Mexico? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams is in Nogales, Mexico, and she joins me now. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Lizzie.
What is the general mood down there about the new administration?
It's generally negative, as you could imagine. I mean, given some of the rhetoric from Trump during the campaign and other times, but people are talking about it a lot less than I expected. There's lots of other economic and political problems facing Mexico right now, ongoing issues of corruption and drug-related violence, not to mention new problems like the declining value of the peso and spiking gas prices.
Yeah, the gas price situation is pretty fascinating. Prices have spiked by, you know, 15-20%. What has the reaction been there?
There have been a lot of protests. I mean, this is because the government removed some of the subsidies on gas, and the government is also saying that due to an international increase in oil prices, that's partly to blame. Of course, the people here are saying, no, the government needs to keep those prices low, and it's because of corruption and other privatization in the gas sector that these prices are going up. And I mean, I'm seeing bumper stickers on the back of people's cars, people riding with shoe polish on their vehicles, messages against this increase in gas prices. And I also talked to several protesters who were detained at one of these demonstrations. One guy, his name was Alejandro Castro Sandoval. He said I should call him Alexander the Great because he owns this dried fruit and nut company, and he says they're so amazing that I should call him Alexander the Great. But he was there at one of these demonstrations and got arrested, and says the gas prices are just kind of the straw that broke the camel's back here in terms of the economic situation.
We're not afraid anymore. They're killing us. They're starving us. What difference would be to be killed with a bullet or starving all your life? What's the difference? And we have a message for the government. We can't take it anymore. They have to go. We don't care about Ford Motor Company. Do I care about Donald Trump? I don't care about Donald Trump. I care about my country.
He really just could not be bothered when I asked him about the new administration. He said it was long past time that Mexico learned to rely on itself and that they had their own problems to worry about.
He's saying he wants to worry about his own country, but there is likely to be some impact on Mexico in a Trump administration. We're talking about, you know, tariffs, factory jobs potentially moved out of Mexico, deporting Mexicans potentially living in the U.S. illegally. How is all of that playing out?
People are a little bit worried about these things, but they seem to be taking a wait-and-see approach. A lot of the people to whom I've spoken here seem to think it's mostly talk, or that once Americans start facing a labor shortage or a lack of Mexican fresh fruit in their grocery stores, that any drastic policies will change. But you're right about the impact. There's already kind of been a Trump effect here, with the peso falling sharply against the dollar since his election. I actually visited a flea market here that specializes in clothes bought in the U.S. and resold here, along with other products, including a lot of used products. And they said it's the drop in the peso that is really hurting them. One of the shopkeepers to whom I spoke in these little stalls was 18-year-old Jasmine Antonio.
Well, some of the clothes is local, other is imported, and people think it's expensive too because we have to raise our prices.
Mm-hmm.
since the dollar rise, too.
But when I asked her, she said she wasn't too worried about Trump's effect on the broader economy moving forward.
But we have to learn to adjust to those things. I mean, okay, we have local things like clothes and those sort of stuff that we need to buy. We need to use our resource. We need to explode them. In the past years, we didn't do that.
The other thing she and others complained about at the market was how they used to go shopping just across the border in Nogales, Arizona, but now they can't do that as much because their money won't go as far.
Has there been any talk about the border wall that President Trump says he will build?
Not that much, really, at least not among the many, many people to whom I've been speaking here, because the people who live and work in this area are very skeptical it's even physically possible to build the kind of wall he's talking about. I spoke with local sheriff's office, I spoke with cops, I spoke with ranchers, and they're telling me that this terrain is just too remote and rugged to build sort of this big, beautiful wall that Trump has described. And even when there already exists tall border fencing, people just find a way over or under it. I actually had a chance to speak with a couple of members of the local drug cartel here from the Sinaloa cartel, and I asked them if they were worried about the wall. One of them, who basically shuttles drugs across the border, said he wasn't worried at all about the wall. He wouldn't give me his real name, but said we could call him Bancho.
You fly over it, you jump it, whatever it takes to go over the wall. Before, it was a shorter wall, and they thought that building a higher one, they were going to stop the transit. But on the contrary, one always finds ways to fly over it.
He's more worried about increased technology along the border, like drones and heat-sensing devices, making it harder to smuggle drugs and people across the border.
Marketplace's Kimberly Adams in Nogales, Mexico. Kimberly, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Kimberly's reporting in Mexico is supported by the International Women's Media Foundation's Adelante Reporting Initiative. The U.S. is, of course, not the only country in a profound moment of change. About 6 months ago, the UK voted to leave the EU, or, you know, Brexit. And this week, Prime Minister Theresa May announced plans for the UK to follow through on that vote by laying out her vision for the UK to leave the EU's single market. The BBC's economics correspondent Andrew Walker joins me now to explain it all. Hi, Andrew.
Hello, nice to talk to you.
One of the sort of confusing points here, I think, for people is to understand these two different pillars of, you know, being a member of the EU, the idea of free movement of goods and services across borders, but then free movement of people and labor. And the people and labor part seems to be a no-go for the Prime Minister. How does that resonate in Europe?
Oh, quite badly on the whole. There are many European officials, and here I'm talking about European institutions and individual European governments, who reckon that the four freedoms, free movement of capital being the other one, are indivisible, that they are absolutely central parts of the European project, and you can't pick and choose among them. You have to have all or none. The free movement of people bit is particularly important for some European countries who've seen quite a lot of their workers move abroad in search of better pay or jobs at all, and then in many cases sending money back home to families. And Poland is perhaps the most striking example of that, where there are many people here in the UK from Poland who have been working as a result of the free movement provision. It's also important, though, for Spain, where unemployment is very high, painfully high, in fact, among young people. And this was simply a red line for Mrs. May. I mean, she reckoned that many people had voted in the referendum because they wanted to see better control of immigration. And so she recognised that getting control of immigration from the European Union was simply not going to be compatible with maintaining full membership of the EU's single market, although she is still keen to get the maximum possible freedom of movement for goods and services. It's just that just how much that is will be very much a matter for negotiation.
Yeah, you have written about sort of what that means and what free trade would look like between the UK and Europe. Do we have any sense of that at this point?
Well, we know some things, I suppose, about what it might conceivably look like. And the EU has free trade agreements with quite a number of non-members and has been negotiating rather slowly with the United States for one. And the basic idea is that is typically that tariffs, that's to say border taxes on goods, will go as far as can be agreed to zero, or at least to very low levels. Increased mutual recognition of the other side's product standards and so forth, easier access to services markets. But I have to say that, you know, that's stuff that, of course, that Britain already has with the rest of the European Union. The question is how much would be lost in the course of departing and in the course of negotiating some new agreement.
What sort of impacts have you seen then on the economy? I know inflation has gone up a bit, but growth has been faster than predicted. Is there a sense among people that you talk to that these are consequences of the Brexit vote? And are there people having second thoughts?
There's not a great deal of evidence of widespread second thoughts, it must be said. And I think if the government and parliament were to try to show any inclination to try and reverse the decision, then I think you'd be looking at a, frankly, pretty major constitutional crisis. What about the consequences, the economic consequences? Well, one thing that clearly is a consequence of the vote is the very sharp decline there has been in the value of the pound. In terms of the kind of day-to-day performance of the economy, yes, inflation has got a bit higher, and you would expect inflation to get higher because of the decline in the value of sterling, making imported goods more expensive. But the British Office of National Statistics says that actually there's not much direct evidence of that being a factor in the increase in inflation. I mean, we've seen oil prices getting significantly higher. That certainly has been one reason. The general assumption among economists that is that over time, sterling will make itself felt in consumer prices, and indeed has already made itself felt very strongly in the prices that business has to pay for imported fuel and raw materials, but the full impact on the consumer hasn't come through yet. Overall, yeah, the economy is continuing to do reasonably well, and unemployment remains very low.
The BBC's economics correspondent, Andrew Walker, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, Lizzie.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Now, from policies and politics to products, like the chicken nugget. This week, food critic Ryan Sutton from the website Eater wrote the definitive ranking of fast food chicken nuggets. I'm going to read from it. Quote, "The nugget is a gateway drug, a young child's unwitting indoctrination into the corporate culinary industrial complex." Ryan, you go on to write that a nugget is not a chicken tender. So what is it?
A chicken nugget is slightly more complicated than a piece of chicken that's simply battered and fried. The simplest way to break it down is a chicken tender is probably something you can usually make at home, a little bit of effort. A chicken nugget is something that most people would not make at home. And that's why it's so good to eat it out at a delicious fast food establishment.
There is also something, I guess, about a chicken nugget that feels like a quintessentially American product. I mean, that's why we have you on a business show and a plate of chicken nuggets in front of us. But why do you think that is?
Gosh, I don't know. If you want to get truly philosophical about it, you think of old America. You think of manufacturing. The chicken nugget is not necessarily, you know, gastronomy the way it is manifested today, you know, by, you know, celebrity chefs with artisanal products who cut things with their hand, manipulate it minimally, and then cook it or fry it and serve it beautifully. A chicken nugget is part of the larger food industrial complex. It's a quintessentially American product to me because it has been manipulated. It has been taken from its natural state and it has been transformed.
Why did you decide to rate chicken nuggets? Like, what was the moment where that was like, oh, yeah, that seems like a good idea?
Well, good question. probably the catalyst for me to review chicken nuggets on this particular month was, I think one of my editors told me that Taco Bell was making chicken nuggets in the shape of a tortilla chip or in the shape of a nacho. And I thought, well, that sounds tasty, or at least that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
And of course, I tried to find the tortilla chip chicken nugget. I couldn't because it's being test marketed in areas of the country where there is a lower density full-time food riders. There's probably a reason for that. And I decided, well, let me just review all the other chicken nuggets and put things in perspective.
Okay, who won?
Wendy's won.
Not McDonald's.
Not McDonald's. McDonald's, some would argue, has the cleanest flavor. That came in second place for me.
Didn't you describe it as like eating a golden retriever?
It's like eating a golden lab because it's so beautifully blonde. You know, chicken in its natural form has both a clean flavor and a little bit of a funky flavor, especially if you have some skin in there. McDonald's or any other chicken nugget is more of an example of chicken acting as more of a neutral flavor, a conduit for other flavors. The chicken nugget is probably best described as chicken pretending to be tofu, which is why I would argue that if you could make any food vegan or vegetarian in the next few years on a mass scale, it wouldn't be the worst thing if you made a chicken nugget vegan or vegetarian because you're not tasting the meat in the first place. And if you can save a few hundred thousand or million animals from getting slaughtered in the first place, why not do it and serve everyone tofu nuggets? And you know what? Probably wouldn't be able to tell the difference when you tried it.
Okay, I know Wendy's won. So we have in front of us McDonald's chicken nuggets, Wendy's chicken nuggets, and then we may never get the chicken nugget smell out of this studio. However, I'm going to reach across the table. We have a plate of chicken nuggets in front of us.
Try plain Wendy's, okay, which I find to be the juiciest.
Shaped like sort of like the state of Idaho. Okay.
This one
tastes a little bit more like fried chicken, like actual fried chicken.
Fair enough. And it has, more than McDonald's, Wendy's has that brilliant bounciness.
Yeah, it's definitely bouncy.
It's like eating the chicken version of a dense marshmallow.
What has the response been? Have people been yelling at you on the internet?
Well, of course. You know, it's funny. I'm a professional food critic. I've been doing this for over a decade. And I can say reasonably nasty things about extremely high-profile restaurants in New York where dinner for two can easily cost over $800. And I'll have sometimes reasonably few comments in those pieces. But the second you start talking trash about someone's fast food chain, whoa, you better hide out for a while because people have serious opinions because fast food is the type of food that people grow up with. And I think more importantly, for a lot of people of many different income brackets, this is how they primarily interact with food outside of the home. It's a place for them to go quickly, eat food, and leave.
And it's cheap.
And I think that's one of the important things about food criticism, if we're going to continue to exist and for the next decade as journalism downsizes, is to simply be more ecumenical in our criticism. Because if film criticism can regularly have Hollywood movies as a steady dose of their diet, arguably, food critics can do the same with the Hollywood of their own industry.
Ryan Sutton is the chief food critic for Eater New York. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
I'm going to go drink like a gallon of water now.
You should. It's a lot of salt in there.
And that is our show. Special thanks to WAMC for hosting us this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Haley Hirschman. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Brian Allison is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.